Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we are doing today another edition, actually maybe our final edition. I've got to do some review and stuff, but it looks like we're kind of coming close to some of the points I wanted to hit on regarding the special presidential election episodes. And so what we are covering is what I believe America really needs out of a president and what a president really has the power to do. I mean, most people marginalize because clearly, the president cannot create the laws necessary of dissolving these unconstitutional vestiges that those who have served over the course of this country, you know, the lifespan of this country, those who have served, they have created unconstitutional offices, departments, so forth and so on, to where We're looking at, you know, over 90% now, easily over 90% of what the federal government is doing is unconstitutional. I mean, the only thing that they actually have, I've said this before, how many people complain about the what they call the military industrial complex that Eisenhower, kind of with a sleight of hand, pointed to and said, hey, be wary of this. Check your constitution, folks. That's one thing that they're supposed to do. It's one thing that we're actually supposed to have is a good national security. That's their primary focus. And everybody has been so guarded. I mean, to be true, to be honest, there has been, you know, I'll just say unsavory uses of military and actually, the evil doings of America, I shouldn't say the evil doings of the globalists, that's what I should say, in basically co-opting America to do a lot of its bidding in regime changes and forcing globalism. I mean, look at what Bill Clinton did in Somalia. You know, instead of actually helping them, all we did was we made them dependent and we realized, oh, well, I guess you can't enslave people that easily. I mean, the things that we've done is just, it's abominable, but all of those things were actually done unconstitutionally. The people should be held accountable. All of the people involved in pushing the globalist scheme, going back to Wilson trying to create the League of Nations, and then FDR putting us into an unconstitutional treaty with the UN. Because these men really thought that they could do whatever they wanted, and the United States or the people of this country, the good people of the United States, didn't know any better. And they took advantage of our illiteracy, and actually they created our illiteracy. So that really kind of brings me to this one point that I want to get to. But before I dive into some of these points I want to make today, before I get into the presidential special series, there is a final correction I need to make, because when I do make a mistake, I want to make sure I cover it three times. And so with Doug Burgum, I need to make a correction. He did not obtain $2 billion in donations. It was actually $2 million. It was over that. But nevertheless, bottom line is, he was paid for by globalists. If you look at who were the number one contributors, and oh, by the way, the Republican Governors Association PAC, that's not a good, that's a label, but that's a globalist pack. It is basically a pack that wants to make sure that they have globalist Republican governors. You want to know why, folks? You want to understand why there were so many Republican governors that stripped your tyranny away from you in 2020, 2021? Well, it's really simple. It was the globalists that helped seat these guys to make sure that they did unto you what they did. And bottom line, they all violated their oath of the Constitution. There's no emergency powers whatsoever that can be granted to a governor or a state where they can actually strip you of your fundamental privileges and immunities, or what we would call our rights. See, in the Constitution, they refer to them as privileges and immunities, because these are things that are given to us by God. Now, we call them our inalienable rights. But in the Constitution, in Article 4, they were referred to as privileges and immunities. The Ninth Amendment basically laid it out that, you know, even enumerated powers cannot be construed as taking away, you know, those fundamental rights of the citizens of the states, as well as, you know, these, what we call civil rights are the actual rights that are protected, like speech, religious expression. Those are the legally protected by the Constitution. And so when we, you know, when we look at what these, the RPG, or is it, yes, the Republican Governor Association, RGA, I'm sorry, it's RGA PAC, they're the ones that want to make sure that you actually have a globalist touting governor. So anybody that starts taking money, I've had this conversation quite a bit, but when you start talking about candidates and candidates taking money, you're far better off running your campaign on the Constitution and the truth than you are corrupting yourself and or taking money where you could be held, you know, to the piper who's going to call the tune. We don't want you to do the good thing. We want you to do our thing. So anyway. So we've kind of corrected the Doug Burgum record here. I feel like I've fulfilled my personal obligation. And I've made a lot of calls over the past, you know, I'll say 10 years, 15 years in talking about this stuff. And one of the things I constantly get from people is I need that 90-second elevator speech. Capture my attention. Folks, a 90-second elevator speech, all it does is it piques one's interest in, okay, tell me more. Because that's the whole point of a 90-second elevator speech. And I'm telling you, when it comes to saving the Constitution, what it takes to actually save this Constitution and all the different aspects, there's really no 90-second elevator speech. Not even on just on the single First Amendment petition or just on Republic Review. There's really no 90-second elevator speech. You know, you can actually entice them with, you know, just a little, you know, like what the news used to do. Is this your daughter? Film at 11. I mean, and they don't show you, but well, shoot, I'm missing my daughter. Where is she? And you want to tune into 11 or, you know, the most horrific accident of the century. Film at 11. We're going to cover the story at 11 so that they get you all to tune back in at 11 o'clock. Anyway. And that's the whole point, is getting somebody's interest. And the best 90-second elevator speech I've been able to accumulate over the years, and help me make it better if you think so, if you think this is weak. But bottom line, we have a self-governing system. The framers gave us a self-government. The critical operative part is the self. If you really look at our governing process, our public servants take an oath of office. They are legally bound to do one thing. It is to support the Constitution. If they do not do that, then it is our duty and responsibility to use the First Amendment petition to hold them accountable. And we call for their removal if they refuse to redress their grievances because of the 14th Amendment, Section 3. So in connecting the dots in the self-governing system, we have all the power at our disposal to actually have the government that we deserve. The problem is we're not doing our job. We, the people, have the blood on our hands because we're not actually at the steering wheel. You know, the car is still plunging down the road at breakneck speed, and we're just off meandering through the car looking for something while we're all literally in harm's way, all of us, because we're not doing what we need to do. So what is it we need to do? We have to connect those dots, and we have to demand compliance to our Constitution. That's probably the 90-second elevator speech that you can get. And so what are those things? What do we need? Now we dive into those rat holes. But that's really that 90-second elevator speech, because it is our fault. As much as we can blame Wilson, as much as we can blame FDR, as much as we can blame, sorry for the bad froggy sounding voice. I've just been straining my voice too much lately. But anyway, that's just because I'm yelling at people and trying to help them and get them to hear what I'm saying. But really, we have to get involved. And this is why I look at the petitions, the First Amendment petitions, as truly the centerpiece for a movement of getting people, one, educated and engaged and invigorated in, you know, taking back our rights, our liberties, taking back our government. Folks, our time is finite. And I know I'm here harping on what the framers said, what the Constitution means, and all of these things. But I don't want to play down the importance of our own personal salvation, our family's salvation. And it is so important to be centered spiritually. You know, we need to be crying to heaven, you know, to forgive us for failing to do our job. But at the end of the day, if you're not getting up off your knees and doing your job in this self-governing system, then bottom line, folks, you're just a hypocrite. We're just hypocrites. If we ask for forgiveness, if we talk the talk, but we don't walk the walk. There are too few liberty-loving people that are really out fighting for liberty. I mean, they support it. There's good people that throw money at this. Oh, well, I support the Convention of States. Well, that's not going to fix our problem. That actually does nothing to fix our problem. It's a waste of time. It's a waste of money. That concept is not even appropriate. And it's the same thing with those who are fighting the Convention of States and, you know, making that their focus, like the John Birchers. That is a waste of time. What we all should be doing, and actually what leaders would do, is say, this is where we need to go. This is what we need to do. State what has to be done. Don't just become the contrary voice, nor don't be a sycophant. Don't just sit out there and go, yes, sir, yes, 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 yes. You know, this really had this weight on me this past weekend. How many rallies have you gone to since January 6th, 2021? How many events have you attended? How many rallies have you gone to? How many videos have you listened to Frank's speech or Chris Ann Hall or Hillsdale College courses or all of these things that are out there? How many hours have you spent, dollars have you spent in attending events? Now, the question I beg to answer this with another question. How closer are we to actually being where we need to be? I'm here to tell you, folks, we're wasting time going to these events. We're wasting time, you know, paying money for, you know, somebody to come talk to you and point out the obvious with our election system. But even if we got that thing fixed, we still have the problem because we, the people, aren't holding our public servants accountable. So in other words, fixing the election system is not it's not our number one problem. Our number one problem is we, the people. Our number one problem is that we are not doing what we're supposed to be doing. But you can be a part of the solution by actually writing petitions or presenting petitions for signatures and then presenting them to your public servants. That's our part. That's what we have to do. And, you know, as nice as it is to go spend a nice evening at a Lincoln Day dinner or maybe a true Republican, you know, I'll just say a Republican building fundraiser, what have you, in celebrating Madison and the Republican Party, because most all Republican parties don't do that. And so what I'm trying to say is that, you know, regardless of what we do and all of these things, if it is not putting your signature and it's not getting you to stand up and putting your face in front of your public servants and holding them accountable to their oath of office, we're not doing our jobs. We're just failing. And it may make you feel better to go sit in a room with a bunch of people that you agree with, and everybody says amen at the end. And everybody just, yeah, that was so great. I mean, wow, they really screwed us over. These mules that, you know, infiltrated and basically threw all of these bad ballots into the system. Boy, that's just terrible. Well, I can tell you one thing. The guys that are delivering these speeches and or movies, content, or what have you, or gals, they're just doing their job. They're just trying to make money. They're not really fixing the problem. And I don't think their intent is to fix the problem, because there's billions of dollars in this industry of grievance. Bill O'Reilly was right a long time ago when he said this is a grievance industry, and there's billions of dollars to be made. And he's one of them. He was a hypocrite. I mean, he sells his books, you know, killing Lincoln, killing Jesus. You think that that's really solving the problem? Every time I've read, almost every book I read, especially today, it is just drivel because it does not solve the problem. Even my book gets into Republic Review and it points to the solution, but it doesn't do enough, which is why I started writing these articles. And I don't sell my articles at this point in time. You can get them for free right now at reclaimingtherepublic.org. Now, I can't emphasize enough that, you know, time is finite, and it is very, very important that we actually get on our knees and center ourselves spiritually. And then when we stand up, we do everything we can to be a part of the self-governing system. And First Amendment petitions is the act. It's the you know, when the convention state folks tell you, hey, it's in the Constitution, you poke them in the eye and say, so is the First Amendment petition. So why don't you do your job in holding public servants accountable instead of trying to take wax at the Constitution by rewriting it? Get in line, buddy, gal, whatever. The other thing I really wanted to rant a little bit about is we still have an opportunity. We still have hope. And that hope will always be there until our public servants, our state legislatures, allow the Constitution to be set aside. When the government says we got to set this thing aside, we're not going to be abiding by the Constitution anymore. We have to do what's necessary to fix all of these terrible problems that we've created. And, oh, by the way, I mean, that's just the wordplay of, you know, we've had every intention in doing this, and now's the time that we tell you that you don't have any rights anymore. Well, at that point in time, the states have to take their stand. And what you need to do, excuse me, and you need to be very succinct. You need to be very direct. You need to tell your public servants that if they allow that to happen, then what they're doing is they're forcing us to go into a revolution to try to fight for our liberty again. In other words, that's what we have to do. Basically, they're sending us into a very, God's on our side. The odds are almost insurmountable. I mean, it's like a David and Goliath. The military, the technology, what the evil hosts have at their disposal compared to the armament and what, you know, the people, the militia have in their possessions, it's not equal anymore. Not at all. Nope. How many people have night goggle visions? How many people have the right communications necessary? I mean, look at what these guys carry, you know, in the military. Are these armed forces that are going to be coming after us and rounding us up as we revolt? It's not going to be a regular American revolution. And so I'm here to tell you, you need to let these guys know if they're going to force us into a revolution, they're our first targets. Just let them know. If we actually get forced, if they put aside this Constitution where we actually have to fight a revolution, we're going to clean house first. Because getting rid of anybody that could become a part of the ruling class is going to be important, folks. You really got to think about that. You know, you may have sycophants. You may have these, you know, these pawns, these tools that are just sitting in your community. We may actually have to go after them first, especially those that did nothing. But I'm not advocating violence. I'm advocating impressing upon your public servants to understand the ramifications of what they may do. And the first thing that they have to understand is they cannot abdicate their responsibility. They have to take a stand. They're obligated to take that stand. And the best thing they could do for the annals of history and for the records in heaven is to take that stand. And the sooner they take that stand, the better off they are and we are. Period. Period. So let's not forget, we need to really start placing the right perspective on China. We need to understand that they are the hostile, they're the bad guy. And if America needs a bad guy, they're the bad guy. And just like Britain and how Britain infiltrated us, Britain's using them to infiltrate the world. Because when we really look at the globalists and everything else, all things do point to Britain. I can't see it any other way. The Vatican, Britain, and the United States has been a part of that alliance. And now China's coming along, and they're going to just create this sheet that wraps around the world to basically smother all of us into a new form of government. And who's been creating and supporting that new form of government? The United States all the way. From Nixon, Clinton was probably the biggest contributor to their technology and advancements in making sure that they understood the critical things that they needed to so they could start implementing. And our big tech companies gave them their souls so that they could develop artificial intelligence and, you know, this new system of controlling and monitoring the people. They're not our friends. They're not the world's friends. They are the enemy of the world, or at least not the Chinese people, the Chinese Communist Party. So there's a good chance in the next week or two that my show will probably be hit or denied service, because that's usually what happens when I really start ranting on China. But it is what it is. Now, we're in the North Carolina debates, so we'll be picking that up tomorrow. And I've got basically a minute left before we go into break. So let me just kind of get myself all positioned to where we need to be. And as we left off, as it stands, I'm trying to wrap this thing up, and I've got a few things to cover. So what I'm going to do is, after today's show, I'm going to kind of look and see what other topics that is essential for a president to act, a constitutional president, what falls under his realm, what are his responsibilities, what can he do as a leader. And I'm telling you, the one thing we haven't had as a president, not even Donald J. Trump, has been the leader leading us out of this paper bag. And it's a paper bag we could break out very easily if we actually focused on the Constitution and centered on making, you know, full, or getting the government into full compliance and making America great once and for all, period. We could do that. We have the ability to do that. It's just, for some reason, nobody wants to lead us down that path because they can't get rich. And, you know, it's not about anything other than power and money. That's how it is for everybody. I mean, isn't it that way in the churches? Isn't it that way in the education centers? Isn't it that way in business? It's all about the money and power. So anyway, when we come back, we're going to dive right back into this, the presidential issues that you need to be aware of, that we actually need to demand out of our next president.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so one of the things that we were kind of wrapping up was the financial and economic matters that that we're facing as a nation. And obviously, we need to get back to the gold standard or the precious metals and so forth. And one of the things I brought up is the fact that, you know, when the Constitution said gold and silver, I think Hamilton, he was a brilliant man, but he had unconstitutional designs. And I don't necessarily believe that the what he did as the treasurer was an unconstitutional design by adding copper as one of those precious metals that would be, a lower denomination of silver, such as the penny. Because it was just common that that's what they did, but they wanted to make sure that the fundamental backbone was gold and silver. Now, one of the things that they didn't know, one of the things that they didn't understand was platinum and palladium. And so these are other precious metals that have risen to that status of a precious metal. And so we need to look at incorporating that to where we include, when it comes to bars of gold, we need to include bars of platinum and bars of palladium because they're very high, they're far more valuable than silver, and they are a precious metal. And so we need to really look at the resources within each state and what those state resources are. Now, the way we have gone about this, because if you really look at how the federal government actually went about mining and all of that, almost all mining when it came to precious metal was directed towards the government. I mean, there were individuals that were on a gold rush to go out and, out of the creeks and so forth and setting up their own mines so that they could literally, exchange that for gold coins because that was the policy. It was a one-for-one exchange. Now, let me ask you this. If when you had a mine, I mean, that gold was literally worth nothing. Well, actually, I wouldn't say that. It was still a commodity that they could use as a barter, right? It had a certain amount of value. So you could go into the general store who would have a scale and they would weigh the gold, but they didn't like doing that and they stopped doing that because they didn't have the full verification if that was all gold or not, right? So they really started pushing that it needed to be in a gold currency. Now, if you were in a remote enough area, they would still do it because it was what was available. You know, it's not like bags of gold and silver were coming in as a standard to put in everybody's pockets. So some of the times it was literally those nuggets that were coming out of the creek that would be moving around town. And these commodities would be given as an exchange for the coin. In other words, when you had a pound of gold, you'd get a pound worth of coins back. And so the intent of the Treasury Act, if you look at it, was to make sure that the government wasn't making money, nor were the people making money off of mining. So let's look at it this way. if you have, you know, the mine and you're pulling gold out, and the only source, the only entity that you can give that to would be the government. And the government would then exchange that for gold or what have you in coins and give you an equivalent of that. So in other words, what they would be giving is a commodity back to you at that same value. Now, your cost, because as you have to pay other people, because mining and all of that, I mean, you have to pay yourself. So there's a cost to doing this. And this is what really brings up what some people would say, what is the cost of gold? What is the cost of mining all of that stuff? It clearly isn't necessarily the total amount. In other words, it's not the effort that it takes, the resources that it takes, the dynamite and all those types of things to get that out of the ground and into the hands of the Treasury is not that amount. But we're looking today at, you know, it costing, and this is all because our labor is inflated. So when you think about it, and when you look back at, you know, the intent and actually the concept that Jefferson put out, you know, a lot of people don't like talking about this because this is one of the things that he actually said, that the earth belongs to the living. Now, what does that mean? The earth belongs to the living. Does that mean that people can actually own and buy and control the earth for their own benefit? Yes, property rights did exist back then, but the intent was for the betterment of society. You got to look at what he's saying in an Enlightenment view, because it wasn't about, you know, how I did all this. As a matter of fact, Jefferson really didn't care about building an empire. He actually spent his empire into oblivion. The creditors foreclosed on his estate the day he died. As they were preparing his body for the funeral and so forth, they were literally moving stuff out of his house and taking it, you know, so that they could get their due. And there's no doubt in my mind that many of these creditors came in and they, you know, grabbed a couch or whatever, and they sold those things because they were Jefferson's and they were labeled Thomas Jefferson's couch, Thomas Jefferson's bed, you know, because people around the world, oh, I'd love to buy that. So, it actually, these guys were making money off of this great man. And in a way, that's just really like sick and sad at the same time. But anyway, when we start looking at resources, and what I'm talking about regarding all these resources, the states need to shift their paradigms. You know, I challenge that there's no constitutional standing for the federal government to own any resources within a state and control them. They can't do that. But is that for private property or is that for state? States are sovereign entities. I'm suggesting, folks, that we actually start really considering how the states need to manage these resources. How do they need to manage the mountains, the trees, the water, you know, the dirt? It even comes up because when we look at some of the most populated areas, like look at Silicon Valley, or if you look in the Pacific Northwest, right there, you know, south of Seattle, Tukwila and that area, that is some of the most fertile soil areas of the world. I mean, they could be growing, you know, an abundance of crops right there in the metropolis of Seattle, the metropolis of San Francisco. Well, why aren't they doing that? Well, because they converted that area to concrete and asphalt. They put a city on top of it. And so we really need to start considering where can we actually benefit the most out of growing, you know, our crops? It ain't going to be at the tops of the mountains. And so there needs to be these real serious discussions of creating strategies so that, you know, the state planners can actually say, you know what, we really do need to recover that land so that we can use that land for growing food, so that we can actually have farmers. Actually, we have downplayed the farming and what, you know, farming brings until we now all of a sudden have had a taste of a shortage of food. How bad does it need to get to tell you we don't want to be in that position, right? And you've heard me already say that the states should not allow the federal government to have the CCC, which is, I believe, the Commodity Credit Corporation is what I believe that the CCC stands for. It's a federal entity, and these are the guys that control the national food storage. It's the grain silage that Bush emptied in 2006, and it was continued to be emptied by Obama, where in 2010, when all of the silage that they had stored up over the years was gone, then all of a sudden the cost of food shot up and caused the Arab Spring. You know, in other words, it was a form of manipulation. As inflation started getting worse, you know, we were able to offset inflation on food to keep food at an unnatural low price until all of a sudden 2010. 2011. And it takes a little while, right? I mean, once the food in process is actually out in distribution in that final year of 2010, it usually takes a year for you to really feel the effect of the shortage. Thus, in 2011, when we felt the effect of the shortage, there was an Arab Spring. There was a lot of calamity across the world. It was literally a man-made crisis. Because had they actually allowed the prices to adjust normally, then the nations, like the Arab nations, would have been able to adjust to those prices. Now, when all of a sudden you go down to go buy food and food is doubled in price, you say, well, I need more money. Well, where were the people getting their money? They were getting it from government. Most of these governments, the Arab nations and so forth, they're socialist in kind. So anyway, we really need to start having very, very serious conversations regarding property rights, because I think property rights for your dwelling and for your subsistence is important. They have to be protected. Absolutely. First and foremost, your property rights, the individual property rights, must be protected. But when you get into ventures and business and so forth and property for that type of thing to where you're making money, then... then I'm looking at the state really needs to step in and say, okay, but you cannot not use that land. In other words, if you have a mine and you're not mining, you decided not to mine, then the state should be able to come in and then lease that land and pay you for the lease of the land to either mine or what have you. In other words, piss or get off the pot. You cannot... You as a person, you as a corporation, cannot execute economic warfare in a state in this union, because that's what businesses do. They're exercising economic warfare by suppressing their prices, by withholding. That's what OPEC does. Cartels like that are unconstitutional. And so we really need to start looking at, you know, how these states need to fix this, because as we become successful in taking this back, the states really need, and we the people, need to be a part of the conversation. And you know what? I'm telling you, there's a lot of people that are not smart on this. I mean, I'm not even saying I'm the smartest guy on this, but I'm telling you that there are really good, smart solutions of how we can actually, delegate those responsibilities, because the state needs to have those responsibilities. And it needs to be really we the people. And it really, this is one of the reasons why we need to actually look at county constitutions, because in actually pulling all the power back down to the county and even farther down in some of these, I'll just say suburban areas, or I should say metropolises, you know, when you have a big city and you have that many people there, then maybe we need to start pulling that power down at a lower level. But these are things we have to be aware of, and we have to be prepared to have these conversations. We need to prepare the states that any U.S. businesses operating outside of the United States, and I know I've already said this, it's just worth repeating, that they will be operating at their own risk. They will need to immediately return to the U.S. and whatever their investments are, lick your wounds because, you know, you shouldn't have been over there in the first place. You're a U.S. business. You operate out of the U.S. We're not a part of the global governance. The United States is the global governance if you're going to operate that way. And we're going to move forward because we're actually going to, you know, put it out to states around the world that there's no reason why they can't be a state in the United States. And we're not funding, you know, any of these other international movements. We're pulling all that back. We need to advise the states and the, and I know that there's been a lot of transfers of wealth, but really when it comes down to wealth of the day and we look at how evil nations in the past have squandered their wealth because it's in their nature to do so, because they're not designed to do what's best for themselves and for their people. Look at Portugal and look at Spain. These were the two richest nations of Europe because they were stripping all of the known goods and treasures of America as they pulled those things back to them, as they were doing these conquests. And actually, these conquests, where is Portugal? Where is Spain in the world today when they were taking all of that gold and all of those gems? What happened to all that? They squandered it. And look, these are the nations that, you know, have riots in the street because their people have lived too good of a life because it was all propped up on, I'll just say, crimes, taking from others, that's something you didn't have a right to take. Anyway, we need to also advise the states and U.S. corporations that they need to get back into the shipping business. We can no longer allow, you know, Matco and some of these other nations controlling shipping. I mean, they need to actually start. America needs to be doing our own shipping, period. And we need to start really doing everything by American only. Because bottom line, when we're using other people, it may seem cheaper at that point in time, but we are now dependent on international shipping. We need to advise and prepare all public institutions, such as manufacturers, banks, insurances, and so forth. If you fail, you will go into bankruptcy. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. We will enforce the actual bankruptcies. As a matter of fact, as the President of the United States, I will no longer, you know, hold the what we call these special contracts. Because bottom line, all of this student debt is unconstitutional. They have no ability to create a debt that cannot be forgiven. We have and must, the Constitution demands that we have a uniform banking system on bankruptcy. Everybody has a shot at bankruptcy. And yes, you will suffer the lumps. We may need to even institute, what do they call that, bankruptcy jail or prison? You know, if you can't pay your debt, then maybe you go serve some time. And maybe instead of going into jail, you just have to do community time. There needs to be a level of shame for the consequences of what you've done. You need to restore the honor. We need to restore the honor and integrity of individuals. And the best way to do that is holding people truly accountable. And the bankruptcy court system, I'm telling you, just doesn't do that. Because if you go look at people that have gone into bankruptcy, they've done it more than once. Which means that they're in and out. It's almost like repeat offenders. Oh, well, you know, you don't go to jail if you go bankrupt. Maybe you should. You see my point, friends? Because it's another crime. You making an obligation without the intent of being able to pay it, or if it comes down to where, you know, you have to suffer a little bit, you refuse to because you don't want to live an uncomfortable life because you've created a situation that may force that. I'm sorry. That just doesn't jive. It doesn't shock in my world. We have to actually do what we need to do to pay our obligations. all debt that will fall under all bankruptcy laws. Again, no debts, and I can't drive that point enough. And so let me see here. We have 8 minutes. When we look at the next item, this is foreign policy. So we jump into a whole new field, a whole new topic for the president, because foreign policies is really a whole new paradigm. The world will be notified that the U.S. will honor all trade agreements, but anything, legitimate trade agreements that we had the authority to do. But any treaty, anything that's in a treaty that is not within the enumerated powers, and everybody in the world needs to understand this, that if you're gonna make a treaty with the United States, you better be aware of its enumerated powers, and so that you don't get duped by, you know, nefarious people in trying to create, you know, these obligations, and then all of a sudden you're going to be left out to dry. Because bottom line, if it's not within the enumerated powers, that treaty cannot be honored or enforced. Treaties tying America to foreign polities will be broken because those polities, the United Nations, we do not have a treaty, or we do not have the enumerated power to subjugate the states and the United States to these types of organizations. Same thing with international banking. All of these things are unconstitutional. The security of commerce on the sea. We have an obligation, and I truly believe that we need to actually make the appeal to the world. I don't care if they want to trust China to actually be their safeguards of their commerce on the nation, you know, out on the world, then fine. Trust China. But we have done it so that this whole world has thrived under our protection. And we're looking at actually providing an honest, you know, cost for based on the type of tonnage that you move. So we believe that they need to pay their value, but bottom line, we're so, you know, China may have a navy to attack. They do not have the logistics and the systems currently for a navy operations like the United States. The only other entity in the world that has the ability, and it takes a while to develop a worldwide logistics system for your naval ships. And Russia's the only other nation. And bottom line, Russia, they didn't care about commerce. They only cared about world dominance and so forth. You know, when it came to the law and protecting, you know, the rights and properties, that was America. So we really need to have this honest conversation. We need to actually, and as nations in Europe, South America, Asia, start petitioning and becoming territories of the United States, then that expanse is going to become a natural expanse. So that, you know, the taxes and everything else, that because they become a part of our economic system. So it's not about having to fly or even pay, because they become a part of the contribution of building and securing, you know, our liberties appertaining to us by becoming a part of the union. Foreign aid's going to cease. We are no longer going to be actually giving people a, you know, fish for the day. We're not going to be doing it. We would be happy to aid and assist, you know, in calamities and in problems that we can actually help you in your sustaining yourself. But we're not here to sustain you. The federal government is not even in the business to sustain its states. It has no business sustaining foreign states. So foreign aid has got to go. Nation building has got to go. Other than building, you know, nations of liberty and free sovereign states in this union. So our focus is shifting from building nations that could become hostile or could actually turn their backs on us to actually integrating nations to become a part of this union of liberty. We need to stop doing regime changes. I don't care, you know, what's going on in the politics of others. I only care about holding public servants accountable to the rule of law, and in America, we need to hold them accountable to their oath of office and whether they're supporting the Constitution or not. So admitting states in the union really becomes the center. This becomes the center focus of our foreign policy. You know, if you want us to fight, if you want us to be involved, you need to be a part of, you know, this admission process, and you need to be well on the way of preparing yourself and learning English, adapting to our monetary system, our legal system, common law, and those types of things. I'm going to just take a side right here. I've said this before, but America needs a Blackstone on Constitution or common law under our hybrid constitutional republic. There's nobody that understands this. There's too many people that are applying common law under the British monarchical system. That doesn't fly here in America. We don't have a monarchy. We have a representative government, and we have a multi-tiered representative government with multi-tiers of sovereignty, where the highest level of sovereignty is in your county. The lowest level of sovereignty is in Mordor on the Potomac, what we call Washington, D.C. And so we need to actually start looking, and actually my first agenda, or our president's first agenda, should be going to every single state in the world that is under the thumbs and under the heels being squished by these communist nations, whether it be Russia or China or Britain. We need to actually basically make appeals to the people of Taiwan, Hong Kong, Crimea, and many of these other nations that are, like I said, under the heel of these tyrants, and make an appeal to them to say, have an honest and open election to determine if you want to become a part of us. Because moving forward, we have some dependencies on Taiwan. It'd be in our best interest to convince them to come this way. But it is something that they must foreordain for themselves. They must make that choice for themselves. And I'm telling you, it's an easy decision when they look just across the little aisle there, that, you know, that little body of water between them and China, and go, you know, we already know what's over there, and that is evil. We do not want that employed here. We want to enjoy and look at living life like we see in Hollywood, where people just are able to walk down and do whatever they want to do, you know, and so forth. Having liberty is the desire of all people. You have to be a really evil person to say, boy, we've got to enslave those people. We got to control them. They shouldn't be having fun. Or if they're going to have fun, they're going to have our fun. That's all they're going to do. I mean, that is the epitome of somebody who's a statist. They want to control everything for what you do. But when it comes to dinner, if they're in the mood for having something different, they're going to have something different. There's not one person that's a statist that is truly a statist that submits themselves to the rules and or the needs of somebody else. They all want to have their own car. They want to have, you know, their own. And they don't leave the keys in their car when they park it somewhere so somebody else can use it. This is why, you know, we look at these hypocrites that are calling for communism in the Hollywood industry, the music industry, and so forth. And we see how they're all trying to, you know, keep the profits for themselves and not share, which is causing this whole strike. Now, I didn't get through all of this. I just have a few more things. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at just literally a couple more lines. I will look at what we have to cover and what I have covered, and we'll, in our next episode, we'll either wrap this up and get into content, or I will figure out what else I need to provide so that we have a compendious summation on what America needs. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.